Welcome. Thanks for attending the 220 Sunstone Digital Symposium Session 352, titled Lifting the Lamanite Curse, How Human Genomics is Exposing Mormon Myths. The audio for this session will be available for purchase at Sunstone after symposium. The video recording of the session will be available in the WHOVA app for the remainder of 2020. We're going to ask questions. You can chat the questions in the question and answer. Simon said he'll have time at the end to answer those, about 15, 20 minutes. So please put those in. If there is a slide you have a particular question on, Simon's requested that I could interrupt him to answer that question, but most of the questions will probably be answered at the end. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, there's more than one way to Mormon. We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. About this presentation, the Prophet Josephus claimed that the Book of Mormon is a translation of the recovered writings of ancient American prophets, has attracted intense scrutiny from the day it was published. As a consequence, the book's historicity needed to be defended from distractors and promoted to the faithful. Recent whole genome studies on thousands of indigenous Americans and Polynesians has failed to find a trace of ancient Book of Mormon Israelites in the pre-Columbian Americans or in the Pacific. There is now an enormous body of scientific evidence that raises serious questions about the history it presents, the racist ideas it contains, its use to erase indigenous culture, and the value of persisting with vanishing Lamanite apologetics. I'll now introduce our presenter. Simon Southerton is the author of Losing a Lost Tribe, a Native Americans' DNA and the Mormon Church by Signature Books. He recently self-published The Sacred Curse, which presents the challenges to Book of Mormon historicity raised by whole genome research on indigenous Americans and Polynesians. Simon has a BS degree, Bachelor of Science, and a PhD from the University of Sydney, and led forest molecular genetics research at CICERO, Australia's National Science Agency, for about 20 years. He was a co-founder of Gowanda Genomics, a company delivering forestry molecular marker technology for the international forest industry. Simon served an LDS mission to Melbourne in the 1980s. He's a former bishop, is married to Jane, and they have five children. Simon was excommunicated in August 2005. So Simon, I'll turn the time over to you now for your presentation. Thanks again. I'll mute myself and turn my video off, and the time is now yours.
Thank you. Okay, I'm just going to move my mug over to the right there. Well, thanks very much, everyone, for joining me. I'm really pleased to be able to have this opportunity to speak at Sunstone. I'm really pleased with the direction that Sunstone's heading and the inclusive nature of the organisation now. And I think it's very refreshing and invigorating for the organization to be embracing many other forms of Mormonism apart from the big one. And I think it's taking a positive approach. So to start off with, I just sort of like to sort of hop back to the 1970s when our family joined the church in Australia. We were baptized in 1970. I was 10 years old at the time, and we were during the 1970s, President Kimball was the prophet, and we were completely immersed in the fact that the Book of Mormon was the true history of Native Americans, and it was widely taught and widely believed by the members around me. That they were the descendants of Lamanites. And this included many indigenous Polynesians that were in the wards and branches that we attended in Sydney. So there were, okay, so it was widely taught in the church, both in the Ensign, at General Conference, in documentaries and films and film strips produced by the church under the authorization of the First Presidency. And even in the Book of Mormon, we had images and pictures that depicted Native American civilizations in the Americas. So it's just widely believed that the Book of Mormon taught the true history of Indigenous peoples. And just as a quick refresher of the Book of Mormon history, we have essentially three major groups migrated to the New World: the Jaredites in about 2000 BC, and then two groups at around 600 BC that migrated away from the Middle East. One of these groups, the Mulekites, eventually joined with the Nephites, and then for a brief period they were united together, but then the Nephites were exterminated in about 421 AD, and then the Lamanites survived. So the Book of Mormon was written to the Lamanites. That was the general purpose of the Book of Mormon. It was to restore them to the truth that they were the descendants of the Jews. And so it was really their history. And there's absolutely no doubt that Joseph Smith considered the Aboriginal inhabitants of the Americas to be descended from the Lamanites. This is evidence from both his own history, his own recorded history. In the Doctrine and Covenants, there are numerous references to the Lamanites that lived to the west of where the saints were establishing themselves, and missionaries were sent frequently out on their missions to preach to the Lamanites. And he also, when he was communicating with the press, he simply just referred to the history in the Book of Mormon as as literal history of the colonization of the New World. So there's little doubt that Joseph Smith believed it was a history about all of the inhabitants of the Americas. But there are very striking similarities between, I think what I might do is occasionally move my face when I'm in the way. But there are striking parallels between the Mound Builder myth and the central plot of the Book of Mormon. Now, the Mound Builder myth was a widely held belief amongst 19th century Americans as they were colonizing the North America. They're moving across the Appalachian Mountains into the Ohio and Mississippi valleys, and they would frequently encounter very large mounds, and there were many mounds around Joseph Smith's family, where Joseph Smith's family lived. And digging in the mounds and finding buried treasure in the mounds was a common pastime for people in the area. So, but this quote here is quite interesting because it comes directly out of view of the Hebrews, which is thought to have provided pretty much, I wouldn't even call it a parallel, but pretty much the plot for the Book of Mormon, where you have these civilized tribes come to the Americas, then you have, they split apart, one becomes a hunting, a savage tribe, and then they have lots and lots of wars, and then the savage tribe wipes out the more civilized group. It wasn't until later in the 19th century that the Smithsonian and other institutions took a very scientific approach to excavating the mounds, and they discovered quite clearly that these mounds were the product of the indigenous people that were living that the North Americans were encountering as they were migrating west. And indigenous folk were had these practices where they would, when they buried the dead, that they would exhume their bodies and then they would bury them in larger mounds. And this was a common practice. So the mound builder myth certainly played a significant role in inspiring the development of the Lamanite myth. But the Lamanite myth expanded even further when President Kimball declared in 1975 that the Lamanites, that the Polynesians in the Pacific were the descendants of the Lamanites. So interestingly, Joseph Smith made no recorded comments about the Lamanites, about the Polynesians linked to the Lamanites. But early missionaries, Addison Pratt and his wife Louisa, were among the early missionaries that were teaching in the Pacific, and they found that the Polynesians were much more receptive to the message. And so it wasn't long when Addison returned to Salt Lake, and then he interacted with Brigham Young, and there were other missionaries interacted with Brigham Young. He then declared in 1858 that they were the House of Israel. But curiously, most Polynesians regard the Hagoth to be their direct ancestor, but it's actually quite clear in the Book of Mormon that Hagoth and the people that accompanied him in the boats that they sailed off in were Nephites. So but that's the beauty of myths. They don't need to make any sense at all. One thing that I was we were exposed to an awful lot in Australia because we had so many Polynesians around us in the church, was the voyages of Thor Heyerdahl on the Kon-Tiki. Now, at the time, we regarded Thor Heyerdahl as a scientist and a great discoverer of how migrations took place in ancient times. But he was more of an adventurer than a scientist. But he was also a hyper-diffusionist, somebody that believes that essentially most of the world's cultures were seeded by people and their cultures that were developed in the Middle East. So he was convinced that people from the Middle East had migrated to the Americas, and then they'd migrated further back into the Pacific. So he was convinced that South Americans, Indians, had colonized the Pacific, and the work of Thor Heyerdahl really cemented the Lamanite myth amongst Polynesian members of the church. It was widely publicized, even in General Conference, and Polynesian libraries in the Pacific are just church libraries. This is are filled with the books and the films that he produced. Okay, I'm having a real problem with my face. Let's get it over there. So what I'd like to do now is just turn to the population genetics. And for those of you who are familiar with my book, Losing a Lost Tribe, it dealt exclusively with mitochondrial DNA. And it's a much less powerful DNA technology for tracing ancestry. I don't know if any of you for those of you who have had your family history or your DNA analyzed and your mitochondrial DNA, you've learnt your mitochondrial DNA lineage, it's not terribly informative. However, genomic DNA is far more powerful, and I want to introduce you to the work that's been done over the last 10 years on the genomic DNA front. Okay, just as a quick summary, introduction to or overview of human DNA before we get into the genealogy research that's been done with DNA. I won't say too much about Y chromosome DNA. It's not been used as much for human ancestry studies, mitochondrial DNA was much easier to work with and much cheaper to work with. So much more work was done on the mitochondrial DNA. But the fundamental difference between genomic DNA and mitochondrial DNA, firstly, the amount of information in our genome or our genomic DNA is just enormous compared to mitochondrial DNA. If you were to compare a 500-page novel to our genome, then mitochondrial DNA would barely occupy the first word in the book. It's just an enormous amount of information in the genomic DNA, which until about 2007 was almost inaccessible. So, but technology has moved on considerably, and we can now mine the genomic DNA for the information it contains. So mitochondrial DNA has quite a distinctly different pattern of inheritance. We inherit our genomic DNA has rearrangements from our father and mother, but our mitochondrial DNA, we inherit down the maternal lines, and that's because it's not in the nucleus. If you look in the cell here, the mitochondria are outside of the nucleus. And if you imagine this cell is an egg cell, the sperm comes in, fertilizes the nucleus, and the DNA, the genomic DNA of the sperm is passed into the nucleus. If that cell then goes on to grow, then it's the mitochondria from the mother, the egg cell, that are passed on to the offspring. So sons and daughters will always have the mitochondrial DNA lineage of the mother. So all of the information that's used for DNA genealogy is contained in markers. So a DNA marker is simply a difference between two DNA strands. And that can be between the two chromosomes that we all possess for each of the 22 chromosomes in the genome, or it can be a point mutation, a point difference in our mitochondrial DNA compared to somebody else. And down the bottom, you can see that there are just enormous numbers of markers in the genome that can be used for genealogy. And there's about 20 to 30 markers in the mitochondrial DNA that can be used. So if we look at tracing our ancestry using the mitochondrial line, you can see here that it just doesn't reveal anything about most of our great grandparents going back just four generations. So if you're tracing mitochondrial DNA, you're only seeing one individual out of eight going back to your great grandparents. If you go back 10 generations, it's only one individual out of about 1,000. It doesn't contain nearly as much information. So however, it has still been extremely useful. This diagram illustrates how the markers have been used to distinguish different mitochondrial lineages throughout the world. So each branch point here is essentially a marker point, where a marker has arisen and you then get a new branch. And you can see that the deepest branches occur in Africa, and the shallowest branches are throughout Eurasia. So the mitochondrial lineages that are common amongst Native Americans are the A, B, C, D, and X lineage. And the reason that they have the A, B, C, and D is that the very first mitochondrial lineages that were described were ones among Native Americans and Asians. But already you'll see that there's one of the limitations of mitochondrial DNA, and that is that the Polynesians have a B lineage as well. So Native Americans and Polynesians have been separated for many thousands of years, genetically quite distinct, but they both contain the B lineage. So there's an awful lot of variation within each one of these groups. So I'll say a little bit more about these lineages later on. This is a map that illustrates the distribution of lineage H. If we go back to that previous slide, lineage H over here is a Eurasian lineage. It's more common in Europe. And in, I had my DNA done about, analyzed about 4 or 5 years ago, and turns out that I have the H lineage. But if you look here at the distribution of the H lineage in Europe, you can see it's a vast area of northwestern Europe where the H lineage is very common. So it doesn't give a very tight prediction of ancestral origins, just knowing what your mitochondrial DNA lineage is. If we then turn our attention to mitochondrial DNA, you can see that there's much more information that's carried in the mitochondria. If you turn to genomic DNA, you can see there's this vast amounts of information that it can reveal, because it exposes, it allows us to trace pretty much our entire ancestry. Another important thing that occurs, and it's illustrated in this diagram, is that each generation, the chromosomes recombine. So when a parent passes on a chromosome to their chromosomes to their children, each one of the 22 chromosomes that they pass on will carry segments of both their parents. So this process of recombination occurs every generation, and it has the effect of chopping up the segments of the chromosomes into shorter and shorter chunks from each generation. So you can see here this red chromosome here. It's a full chromosome that's passed on, but then it gets cut and cut again and cut again in each succeeding generation. And this is a very useful feature of genomic patterns of DNA inheritance that has been exploited by scientists to determine how long ago events have taken place in a family history. So a very common way of illustrating genomic DNA is to simplify the vast amounts of information that it contains, is to just illustrate via a pie chart where proportions of your DNA have come from, and people who've had their DNA analysed might would have seen something similar to this. And this is actual data from my own family history. And I just wanted to run through my own family history just to illustrate the power of genomic DNA analysis. So the 8 dots you can see there are my 8 great-grandparents, where they were born. And the blue ones from my father's side of the family and the pink from my mother's. And they're quite well separated. And many of my ancestors come from sort of outlying regions of the United Kingdom. Now, when I analysed the data that came back from the company, I was able to assign pretty much very close to 50% of my DNA to the 4 great-grandparents on my mother's side. But I had a lot of trouble assigning. I couldn't assign more than about 35% to the UK. It turns out that I have about 12.5% of my genome comes from Europe, which is really interesting because I don't have European ancestry in my paper genealogy. So it appears that about almost certain that one of my great-grandparents isn't really my great-grandparents. So one of my great-grandfathers on my father's side. And it turns out that it's more than likely my great-grandfather named Robert Southerton. So it may be that my Southerton Y chromosome came from Germany. And that's quite interesting because when I looked at my Y chromosome, it's more common, it occurs at twice the frequency in Germany as it does in the United Kingdom. So it's quite possible that my great-grandmother may have been pregnant before marrying my great-grandfather. But we don't know what happened, but it's interesting how the genomic DNA was able to reveal at quite quite accurately where my DNA came from within the United Kingdom. And that's because they've got a very powerful database with thousands of individuals who have very confirmed ancestry in parts of the UK that has formed a database. So if you've got a very solid database, you can then predict where, quite accurately, where the DNA comes from. So another thing I should point out is you don't each grandparent on average would contribute, sorry, each great grandparent on average would contribute about 12.5% of my DNA. But that's an average. It isn't always the case. So that's why we would, some are below 12.5% and some are above 12.5%. So as I mentioned earlier, the recombination between DNA is a very useful feature because it allows scientists to determine when admixture events have occurred in the past. So if you have two parents that come from different populations with a whole range of distinctive markers on them, when they have offspring, they pass on their chromosomes, but in each succeeding generation, these chromosomal chunks derived from each of the parent populations will be broken down. So after many generations, you'll see much smaller and smaller chunks of chromosome can be assigned to the ancestral populations. And how small those chunks get to can be correlated with time. So you can work back, you can estimate when the admixture event took place by looking at the lengths of the chromosomal chunks. So this is this feature has been used quite a lot in recent genomic studies of Native Americans. So this is what the genomic data looks like when you look at the chromosomes of an individual. So this is a process called chromosome painting, which has been used to determine the ancestry of the chromosomes in one particular individual. So this is data from one person, and it's a person who had an English parent, and that's why you can see in every single one of their 22 chromosomes, one of the chromosomes is entirely red. So that chromosome came from parent A, B. But in this example, the other chromosome came from a parent that had a little bit of Swedish ancestry. And it's the average length of these chunks will tell us roughly how long ago that Swedish ancestry entered into this family, into this individual. So what I'd like to do now is just to run through some of the data on Native Americans. Then I'll talk about Polynesians, and I'll talk a little bit about the mitochondrial DNA analysis because it is still valuable information. It was the earliest information, and it was sufficient information to really clearly identify the origins of both of these groups. But it has been there's been some amazing discoveries in just the last year that have added much more insight into the sort of finer details of migration into both the Pacific and into the Americas. I put this slide in because it's a very useful illustration of how the uniqueness of the New World and the Pacific in terms of the history of human migration. The biggest barrier to to human migration into the Americas and into the northern parts of Eurasia has always been the ice, the presence of ice. So as the glaciers have moved down, it's been very challenging for humans to migrate through it. And so it's been an effective barrier to migration. But for a long time, it's been thought that Native Americans migrated after the into the New World after the last glacial maximum. But there's been some very interesting discoveries this year that suggest that may not be the case. They may have actually entered the Americas earlier. Another area where humans have very recently colonized is the Pacific. And these lines here illustrate the migrations, the amazing migrations of the Polynesians just within the last few thousand years, even over to Madagascar. So they're very different in their timing and the colonization of the Americas and the Pacific. So it's been known for a long time that Indigenous Americans have Siberian ancestors. You only have to look at a Siberian and you can see very clear, very striking similarities between them and Native Americans. And it appears from DNA and archaeological evidence that the ancestors of Indigenous Americans migrated from around Lake Baikal, which is a very large freshwater lake in central Siberia, which is where humans have colonized for probably the last 40 to 50,000 years. As I mentioned before, the Ice Age was considered to be a large barrier to human migration. However, it did make it possible for humans to colonize, to actually walk into the Americas, because during the Ice Age, large volumes of ice were trapped in the polar caps and in large glaciers over much of North America and Eurasia, and that lowered the sea levels. And because of the ocean currents, there was a region called Beringia between Alaska and Siberia that was exposed during the Ice Age, and that enabled Siberians to migrate into this region about 20,000 years ago. But then as the Ice Age came to an end, sea levels rose, and that so now we have that region is about 90 meters underwater. So the for many years it was believed that the first Americans were Clovis, the Clovis people, and the reason for that is that there were just literally tens of thousands of Clovis spear points found all over North America. So each one of these dots on this graph illustrates points where Clovis spear points have been found. And as you can see, there's just huge numbers scattered all the way across North America, particularly over in the east. And these very distinctive Clovis spear points, you can see here, had, I guess, a very powerful impact on scientists. For a long period of time, the Clovis were believed to be the first Americans, but there was sort of growing pressure at around about the turn of the century as the DNA evidence started to accumulate. It became quite clear that the amount of DNA variation that occurred in Native Americans and the timing of its entry into the Americas, all the evidence pointed it to being much earlier than 13,000 years ago. And this is a picture that I drew for a paper that a chapter that I wrote for the Global History of human migration several years ago. And this picture summarized what was known from the DNA evidence. This is what DNA evidence suggested. It was increasingly becoming clear that the earliest colonization occurred around about 19,000 years ago. So that created quite a problem, because the Clovis culture was believed to have entered through an ice-free corridor that opened up about 13,000 years ago. But as scientists, I guess the DNA evidence produced this pressure to look harder to see if there was evidence of earlier migrations. And there's been some amazing research in the last couple of years that has really revealed very clear evidence that humans were in North America about 16,000 years ago. And just 2 weeks ago, they've found evidence of humans occupying caves in Mexico as early as 30,000 years ago. Now, this is a very striking discovery and a very momentous discovery, this one here in Mexico, because what it suggests is that humans entered the Americas before the last ice age. So, and a further piece of the puzzle that suggests they were not connected with the Clovis culture is the stone spear points that they've uncovered are quite clearly different to the here we go back to the slide on the Clovis. You can see these are very sophisticated spear points, and these are a much simpler spear point or arrowhead that's been identified here. So there's growing evidence that Native Americans were present in the Americas much earlier than we originally thought. So if we look at the mitochondrial DNA of Native Americans, and considerable amount of research has been done now. About 16,000 individuals have been screened from numerous tribes across the Americas, and about 99% of them have a lineage, either the A, B, C, D, or X lineage that's found in Asia. A very small proportion, 1 or 2% of Native American mitochondrial DNA lineages are either European or African. If we look now at pre-Columbian individuals, so this is work done on over 12,000 ancient remains. So these are people that lived over 200 years ago, 300 or 400 years ago, that had no contact with Europeans or Africans since Columbus. Most of these are individuals that are probably 500 to 1,000 years, lived 500 to 1,000 years ago. We find that all of their lineages are Asian lineages. So the other thing that can be done with mitochondrial DNA is to look at the variation within each of the lineage groups or haplogroups. And several groups have looked at this sort of data and determined and estimated how long ago these lineages existed. And it's in the vicinity of 18 to 20,000 years ago that the first individuals, so all Native Americans descend from an individual that lived with that lineage, descend from an individual that lived about that long ago. So these would have been individuals that lived in Beringia about 20,000 years ago. If we turn now to genomic DNA, this has been used to look at large numbers of individuals, Latin American individuals. So these are people that have both Latin American and indigenous ancestry. And in this particular research, the scientists were looking to determine where their ancestry, where their admixed ancestry came from. And you can see quite clearly here. So first of all, the scientists analysed DNA from European countries to determine markers that were specific to those countries so they could determine where this ancestry occurs, or this admixture occurs in South American populations. And then they analysed the DNA of thousands of indigenous Latin Americans or Latin American individuals. So each one of these little tiny pie charts that you can hardly see is an individual, or the location, so it's where a person was born, is its geographical position. And the colour of these in these pie charts illustrates where the admixed DNA came from in Europe. And of course, the first thing that stands out quite clearly is that this lines up very well with the historical record. So all the way down the west coast of South America, you have large amounts of Spanish DNA. So the red being Northern Spanish and the orange Southern Spanish. And over in Brazil, very large amounts of Portuguese DNA and also Italian DNA. What scientists have also found in this study of 6,500 Latin Americans was that a small proportion of the DNA in Latin Americans, small proportion of the European DNA is actually derived from the Middle East. So either Eastern or Southern Mediterranean. And a proportion of that, about half of that DNA, is most similar to Sephardic DNA. Sephardic being the branch of the Jews that migrated around the Mediterranean, as opposed to the Ashkenazi that migrated into the Rhineland in Central Europe. So, and again, here you can see an interesting pattern here. The vast majority of the Sephardic DNA that we're seeing in individuals is in countries that had a very high proportion of Spanish DNA and hardly any Sephardic DNA over in Eastern South America. So scientists were interested to determine when this Sephardic DNA arrived in South America, and so they did the tract analysis on the Spanish DNA, the Sephardic DNA, the Italian DNA, and the North European DNA, and they were able to determine that the Sephardic DNA arrived in the Americas at the same time as the Spanish DNA. So the Sephardic DNA is almost certainly derived from a group who they term the Converso Jews. So when the Jews migrated out of the Middle East in the 4th and 5th and 6th centuries into Spain, they were highly persecuted, and quite a few of them sort of converted to Christianity in order to avoid persecution. And it's more than likely that they also were quite keen to move away from Spain when the opportunities arose in the Americas. So, but here it looks quite clear that the Sephardic DNA that's present in South American populations came from the Converso Jews that came on the Spanish galleons with the migrating Spaniards and in the 15th and 16th centuries. Okay. Genomic DNA has also revealed some very interesting secrets just within the last few years. in terms of more distant ancestors amongst Indigenous Americans. This study was published in 2015, so each dot here represents a modern day individual whose entire genome was screened with about 500,000 markers. And then these individuals were compared with each other, and scientists identified that there was a tiny proportion of DNA amongst several South American populations that was similar to DNA found in Australian Aboriginals and the Ong, which is a very ancient group that are very closely related to Australian Aboriginals. The first Australasians migrated out of Africa and down through India, they would have travelled through here, this region here. But it's only a very tiny proportion of DNA. So this heat map here illustrates the proportions of DNA from Australasians that's present in these South American populations. So at the peak here, it's only about 2%. So most of them, it's much less than 1%. It's a very tiny proportion of their DNA as came from Australian Aboriginals, which begs the question where it came from. And my personal opinion is that this is most likely to be the DNA of the people that were occupying that Mexican cave 30,000 years ago. And when the wave of Clovis and other Native Americans came down along the coast and they migrated south into South America, they just mixed with these people. So I suspect that's where this Australasian DNA came from. So it was the DNA of the very earliest migrants into the New World. There are also other ancient ancestors that have been found amongst in the ancestry of Indigenous Americans. That's Neanderthals and Denisovans. Most of you have probably heard about the fact that many of us have very small proportions of Neanderthal DNA, and that's the case with Indigenous Americans. But there is another ancestor that ancient group called the Denisovans that occupied parts of Eastern Asia, and very small traces of Denisovan DNA have been found in several Indigenous groups in the Americas. But now turn our attention to the Polynesians, and here it's quite a different story. Because the migrations into the Pacific were fairly recent, we have fairly strong linguistic connections between Polynesian groups and their ancestors in island Southeast Asia, going through into the Philippines and Taiwan. So for many years, it's been suspected that the ancestors of the Polynesians were the Taiwanese and Filipinos. But DNA has shed much more light on this over the last few years. So this is some work that I published in Losing Lost Tribe. This is the mitochondrial DNA analysis that was done in Polynesians. And as I mentioned earlier, they have a B lineage, very much like American Indians have a B lineage, but they're quite unrelated. So there are additional markers that occur in Polynesian B lineages that are not present in Indigenous Americans. And you can see here just how far the Polynesian B lineage has been spread around the world. So you can even find it over in Madagascar. So a small proportion of the Madagascar population is descended from Polynesians. So they were just amazingly skilled navigators and travelled over vast, vast differences, vast distances. So so if we turn our attention to the genomic DNA, it's been able to reveal quite clearly the links and the relatedness of Polynesians to other groups, particularly the Filipinos, in current populations today, but also in other places in Southeast Asia. But what scientists have discovered is a very interesting difference between the older Polynesian genomes. Here, a 3,000-year-old Polynesian genome and a present-day Polynesian. So present-day Polynesians have about 17% of essentially Australasian DNA. So it's DNA from New Guinea and Melanesia. However, when they analysed the DNA of a 3,000-year-old Polynesian in Tonga, they found no New Guinea DNA. So there's no Australasian DNA present in the first Polynesians. So what appears to have happened is Melanesian DNA has entered Polynesians after they've migrated out into the Pacific, and I'll show that in the next few slides. So we look at the early colonisation of the Pacific. Australia, 40,000 years ago, Australia was colonised. Sahul is the landmass, that's the name of the landmass encompassing Papua New Guinea and Australia. And humans had reached the Solomon Islands by about 30,000 years ago. Then beginning 3,000 years ago, the Polynesians migrated out of Taiwan through the Philippines and then straight out into the Pacific. So they colonized briefly islands here, New Island in Papua New Guinea, but then they colonized Vanuatu, Fiji and Tonga about 3,000 years ago. This depicts the sort of craft that they had. They built these very large outrigger canoes, double-hulled canoes that were extremely stable. They were tremendous navigators, and these skills enabled them to colonise, to travel very large distances. If we look at more recent colonisation of the Pacific, as the genomic DNA suggested, the Melanesians, there was contact between the Polynesian groups in the Fiji and Samoa and Tonga and Melanesia. So Melanesian DNA entered their Polynesian genomes about 2,000 years ago. About 1,200 years ago, Polynesians had reached Polynesia, so French Polynesia over in the east. And then within the space of only a few hundred years, they scattered in all directions, very large migration events, and they traveled over very large distances to colonise most of the rest of Polynesia. To give you an idea of the scale of these journeys and how well-equipped they were and how skillful they were, the migration to New Zealand is believed to have taken place several times. So they sailed from French Polynesia to New Zealand and back again and then back to New Zealand. So there were several migrations that occurred. The distance here is 4,000 kilometres between New Zealand and French Polynesia. So these were highly skilled sailors using the currents, the winds, the clouds, the stars to navigate. So they really knew where they were going were remarkable colonisers. But a very fascinating piece of research was published only a couple of months ago, which shed even further light on the origin of, on Polynesian ancestry. In this study, Ioannidis analysed the genomes of several Polynesians and also several groups along the western coast of the Americas. And they used this tract analysis to identify when the DNA arrived in the Pacific. So they found clear evidence that the Xenu of Colombia arrived. Xenu DNA arrived in French Polynesia about 800 years ago. That DNA was then spread to other islands in French Polynesia over quite a large distance, and some even ended up in Easter Island. And they also found that there was Puenchi DNA in Easter Islanders. Now, but this DNA arrived only in the last 140 years. So this DNA, the Puenchi DNA, almost certainly arrived with Chileans in modern times, in the modern era. But this, the Xenu DNA, clearly arrived in the Pacific about 800 years ago. In my view, it's more than likely, I think it's far less likely that this was the result of South Americans sailing into the Pacific. Given that the Polynesians had colonized such a vast area, I think it's far more likely that Polynesians reached South America and then came back, and they brought back Native Americans with them into the Pacific. And I'll talk a little bit about that a bit more later on. So this is actually an illustration of a single individual from Easter Island that had Xenu ancestry. And this shows you what their chromosomes look like. So this individual clearly had a European, one European parent. And you can see the small chunks of Xenu DNA present on the chromosome of their Polynesian parent. And the size of these indicates just how old it is. So it's if it had been a very recent introduction, these chunks would have been enormous, would have been much, much larger. So that was a really interesting piece of interesting discovery that was made in just the last few months. So there have been other minor pre-Columbian contacts that I wanted to just briefly mention. The Polynesians reached California. It's likely that the Polynesians reached California about 800 years ago, or 1,200 years ago, because they have found archaeological evidence for in California. It's also like we know for a fact that the Vikings reached North America in eastern Canada in a place called Vinland. And of course, we have the Xenu DNA being present in French Polynesia. So these are all fairly minor contacts. Now, some may be aware of the idea that the sweet potato is evidence of South Americans colonizing the Pacific. It's more than likely the DNA evidence suggests that Polynesian sweet potatoes are quite distantly related to South American sweet potatoes. In fact, they share a common ancestor about 100,000 years ago. What that suggests is that the sweet potato in the Pacific was present before humans came anywhere near the Americas or the Pacific. So what I'd like to do is just very quickly run through some of the limited geography apologetics that I've encountered since I've become aware of the DNA evidence. And this is because the point I want to make is that the LDS scholars have known for some time, well before the DNA came along, that there was little evidence that Israelites had colonized the Americas before Columbus. And when I came, I was quite taken when I came across some talks that were given at a BYU roundtable in 1969. And in many ways, this talk sparked the beginning of modern day LDS apologetics, Book of Mormon apologetics. In the opening talk, Dee Green admits that the research in South American research, research in the Americas that the church had done and other scholars had done had failed to find any evidence of a Middle Eastern presence or influence in the Americas. There's just clearly no archaeological evidence. However, at the end of the talk, John Sorensen then charts the direction of Mormon apologetics. So because there is no hard evidence, no hard archaeological evidence, he then focuses his research on parallels. And he talks about 200 parallels that he's identified between the Middle East and Mesoamerica, and concludes that we can no longer The historical claim of the cultural independence of the two areas from each other, so no historical claim of the cultural independence of the two areas from each other is credible. In other words, he's completely convinced that because of the similarities that he's identified, that Mesoamerican cultures were connected to the Middle East. And that's pretty much the way apologetics has continued to this day, this obsession with looking for cultural parallels. When John Sorensen published his magnum opus in 2011, which summarized pretty much his entire life work, he'd found 420 parallels between Mesoamerican cultures and the Middle East. Interestingly, John Sorensen served a mission in the Pacific at the time that Heyerdahl's voyage took place in 1947. And he became pretty much a rusted on hyperdiffusionist. So he was completely convinced that Polynesian cultures came from the Middle East via the Americas. But he also became what I refer to as a parallelomaniac. He just completely obsessed with similarities between the two cultures. But this methodology, there is an extremely weak methodology. Even LDS apologists who have published research on the limited geography believe that this approach is fundamentally flawed. If you have a fixed conclusion that the Book of Mormon is a true history, and you take this parallelomania approach, you will only see parallels. You will only see evidence that supports your views. So what, just briefly running through what the Mesoamerican limited geography is, it locates all of the events in the Book of Mormon in Central America. The narrow neck of land is the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, and the Book of Mormon lands are to the east and south of the narrow neck of land. And if we look at some of the cultures that existed in this area, the two major cultures, Mesoamerican cultures that were present in this area, are the Olmec, and they were, I guess, the more ancient culture, and the Maya. So the Olmec occupied the northern coast of southern Mexico, whereas the Maya occupied the highlands of Guatemala and southern Mexico and the Yucatan Peninsula. So the limited geography apologists have focused all of their attention on the Olmec and the Maya. This is largely because these cultures flourished at roughly the right time for the Book of Mormon civilizations. However, they don't match terribly well, because the peak of the Mayan civilization is mostly after the Book of Mormon period, and this is when the Nephite civilization was destroyed. And both the Maya and the Olmec, they had a very long formative period. So the cities that are present in the classic Maya existed for many hundreds, if not thousands, of years before they became quite large and archaeologically more visible, because they had stone buildings. So simplistically, the LDS apologists have considered the Olmec to be parallel with the Jaredites, and the Mayans to be the equivalent or the parallel civilization to the Nephites. And there is a clear reason why the Maya, they've focused their attention on the Maya, and that's because there are three criteria that they meet that are essential for the Book of Mormon civilizations. The most important one is that they had a written language, but they also built very large cities, and they exist at about the right period of time. There really is no other alternative in the new world. So that's why they focus their attention on the Maya. But some of the more recent apologetics I've found extremely troubling. This, in a DVD produced by Brigham Young University in 2007, Journey of Faith to the New World, John Sorensen makes some very, very disturbing claims about the rise of the Mayan civilization. He pretty much states that the Mayan civilization was basically kicked into existence by the introduction of the more sophisticated technology and cultural practices of the Nephites. And it's just staggering that this still goes on, because there's absolutely no connection at all between the Mayans and in Middle Eastern cultures, none whatsoever. And this is just racist. And this needs to be, they just need to stop saying things like this. It's very sad to see an indigenous Mesoamerican completely sucked in by these North American white man's myths. Really sad to see that he now believes as well that a Middle Eastern culture kicked his ancestors' civilization into existence when there's absolutely no connection. If we look closely at the Maya, there's been a lot of DNA work done on them, and there's clearly absolutely no connection between them and the Middle East. So if we look at the mitochondrial DNA, there's a very tiny fraction of the Mayan. Only one individual out of 633 was found to have a European lineage. You could consider this a candidate Lamanite. But if we look very closely at the mitochondrial DNA, okay, if we assume that this one individual is a potential Lamanite, that's just over 1,500 per million potential Lamanites. But the genomic DNA, if we look closely at the genomic DNA, it tells us that the vast majority of the European admixture is Spanish, a little bit of Portuguese and other Europeans, tiny little bit of Sephardic. We're down to now about 60 per million. If we assume that this is Lamanite DNA, but the tract analysis tells us that this is Sephardic DNA. So essentially we can say, after all of the work that's been done in South America, they can't detect indigenous. So they cannot detect putative or potential Lamanite DNA. If we turn to the church response to the DNA, it's more than likely that the DNA evidence pressured the church to change the introduction to the Book of Mormon. So they're shifting away from the principal ancestors to being among the ancestors of American Indians. I would argue that this introduction to the Book of Mormon is entirely consistent with the Book of Mormon itself and everything that Joseph Smith ever said about the Book of Mormon. But this is now, the church is now retreating to this position. In 2014, the church published the DNA essay. I just want to quickly run through and respond to some of the, you could spend an hour on the essay, but I just wanted to respond to some of the major points. This first claim is just so tiresome. We see this all the time from apologists. Science is always changing, so we never really know anything. But there has been a scientific consensus about the ancestry of Indigenous Americans for 100 years. We're learning little bits more and more and more, and it's becoming more and more refined, but the essential story has not changed in that time. The DNA essay does admit that Native American DNA is largely Asian, and Lehi DNA hasn't been found. To be fair to those who wrote the essay was written when they were only looking at the mitochondrial DNA, but the The genomic DNA shows that we can clearly, we easily detect very small traces of ancestral groups to Native Americans, but we find no evidence of what were very significant Lehi populations. It also makes the claim that we don't know what Lehi DNA looks like. We don't actually need to know what Lehi DNA looks like. The main thing is we know it's not Asian. It would be Middle Eastern DNA, and there's no sign of pre-Columbian Middle Eastern DNA in the Americas. It also claims that Lehi DNA has been lost. It could have been lost due to bottlenecks, admixture, lots of other reasons. But this creates significant issues because the Book of Mormon was written to the Lamanites, and if we can't locate them, then it essentially defeats the purpose. The focus on limitations of the technology is just, given how widely now genomic DNA is used for tracing ancestry, it's hard to see, it's hard to defend this claim that the technology has enormous limitations. I want to just talk briefly about one of these claims that annoys me the most, probably this one that science is always changing. And this is a claim that was made in a National Geographic story back in 2014. Now, I should point out National Geographic is not a scientific magazine. It's a popular science magazine. And there's a huge difference. So it may have been a great surprise to the journalist that was writing this article that a third of Native American genes come from Eurasia or Western Eurasia. But it wasn't a huge surprise to scientists. Scientists have known for a number of years, for many, many years, that Indigenous Americans carry Eurasian DNA, and some of that DNA came from Western Eurasia 30,000 years ago. Because the individual that was studied, this MA1 individual, which was the subject of that study, the DNA was from a 24,000-year-old Siberian. What study showed, that this individual had very close ties to Indigenous Americans and loose ties to many populations up in the higher latitudes. The paper in question was looking at ancestry connections 25,000 to 30,000 years ago and was completely irrelevant to the Book of Mormon period. I don't want to dwell too long on this. Book of Mormon apologetics drives me crazy. But one of these, one of the approaches they have taken is to reinterpret what the word Lamanite means. And this claim here from Sorensen is just completely ridiculous. It could also refer to basically everyone. So essentially anyone, everyone's a Lamanite. So the term becomes almost meaningless. Meldrum and Stevens even likened it to a meme. So if you had a distant ancestor that had just sort of mixed with a genetic Lamanite, they would then become a Lamanite. Familial terms that were common, like for 1,000 years, the Lamanites and Nephites referred to each other as their brethren, their descendants, their seed, their children. But no, they, according to Roper, these were adopted Lamanites. They weren't genetic Lamanites. But what about all the statements by God in the Doctrine and Covenants and the ones made by Joseph Smith? According to Roper, they're just the opinions of the prophet. They don't really matter. I just find it hard to take these guys seriously because they don't talk for the prophet. They don't have any authority. They don't. If we start hearing the prophets say these things, then we can maybe pay attention. I'll skip over this, but there are many textual problems with all of the apologetics, and not the least of which is the book makes no mention of vast populations that surrounded the Nephites or the Mulekites and Jaredites. They must have run into these unmentionable Native people. There's just enormous problems with this apologetics. One thing that continually frustrates me is that Fair Mormon just perpetuates lies. There were false claims were made by Keith Crandall back in the Book of Mormon DNA, Book of Mormon New World DNA DVD that was produced in 2008. He claims that there was Middle Eastern DNA found in the Mayan population as opposed to across North and South America. And then he ridicules population, the critics like myself, who he claims don't understand population genetics. It's a very tricky kind of data. Well, it turns out that Keith Crandall himself was tricked by the data, and he's referring, what he's referring to as Middle Eastern DNA is in fact European DNA. And as the genomic studies have shown, it's all vast majority of the European DNA in Indigenous Americans is Spanish and Portuguese, and the tiny proportions of Jewish DNA came in after Columbus. So it just annoys me that this sort of stuff is still produced. I've complained to Keith Crandall. I'm not even sure if he's a member of the church anymore or attends anymore. He left BYU a couple of years after making these claims. And I haven't heard from him since. So where to from here? Just to summarise the science, genomic DNA can easily detect traces of ancient ancestry in both Polynesians and Indigenous Americans, but it has failed to find any trace of pre-Columbian ancestry in both of these groups. They are not descended from Mormonism's Lamanites, and these facts are not going to go away. Somebody's not going to turn around in 5 years' time and suddenly find Middle Eastern DNA all throughout the Americas. It looks like the church is beginning to distance itself from the apologetics. And I think this is largely because of social media. Apologetics went on for many years in the background and people didn't see it. But in fairly recently, the church closed farms and sacked some of the apologists. And as recently as 2018, they've been encouraging people to come to the defense of the Book of Mormon, calling for independent voices. And so now you've got Fair Mormon Interpreter, Book of Mormon Central, and even crazy creation of pseudoscience from Rodney Meldrum's Heartland group. So you've got to be careful what you call for when you ask for independent voices, because you get all sorts of stuff. But it's nice to know that even the most ardent apologist, Stephen Smoot, is prepared to admit that you may be able to get into the celestial kingdom without believing in the historicity of the Book of Mormon. So maybe there's a chance for me. I think the biggest problem we have at the moment is that we have this catch-22 occurring at BYU in particular. The brethren believe the historicity. If you question the historicity, and you can see this all the time, we just saw this very brief recently with Brian Howglid, when it comes to the Book of Abraham, if you question the historicity, you then put at risk your membership, your status and your salary. And so the historicity is still continually defended. And I don't think we're ever going to break out of this cycle anytime soon. Maybe we will. There has been a bit of a tendency for the church to back away from discipline for expressing or questioning the historicity. It was refreshing to hear Greg Prince talk recently. Greg believes the Book of Mormon is a 19th century document, and he, in his view, the church is quietly starting to downplay the ancientness paradigm and promoting its the spiritual values of the book. But it remains to be seen if this approach is going to be sustainable. I think it's fair to say that most people that are going through a faith crisis find it difficult to accept nuanced views. From my opinion, looking back over 20 years, there's not too many people hang on to the newest nuanced views for terribly long. I think they're going to be more popular amongst Mormon academics. This view that it's not history, but it's of spiritual value, and more use for Utah Mormons, but less useful, less satisfying for those at greater distance. I think the bigger problem, though, is that the Book of Mormon has been used to erase Indigenous culture for many years. And these are some powerful quotes from Indigenous Americans and a Polynesian, reflecting on their membership of the church and the influence the Book of Mormon's had. I would strongly encourage people that are interested in this to look at, to read Decolonizing Mormonism by Gina Colvin and Joanna Brooks, which looks very closely at the how Mormon culture has erased Indigenous culture and how we need to move beyond this. But there are also considerable problems that need within the Book of Mormon that need erasing, and that's these sort of scriptures. This is just racist, completely and utterly racist. I don't care what sort of the apologetics attempts to erase this, explain away these scriptures are just woeful. They're just 19th century racism that's found its way into the Book of Mormon and need erasing as well. But this is a major challenge for the church. And while I'm at it, I'd like to mention, to point people towards Sarah Newcomb's talk on Manifest Destiny, because the Book of Mormon really has an awful lot of the Book of Mormon supports Manifest Destiny, this idea that the US is God's chosen land and the Constitution is inspired by God. That's going to be increasing. It's going to be really difficult to extract that the church from that. So I think on that point, I'll conclude and acknowledge just some of the contributors to the work here, in particular the folk at Signature Books, and also Thomas Murphy and Gary Edmund in the University of New South Wales, who's helped with some of my recent work. And of course, my wife, Jane, who suffers with my obsession with this. Thank you.
Hey, Simon. Great. We're about out of time, and there were some questions, but I'll go through some of these you already answered. So,
okay.
A lot of more very complimentary on the presentation, and I'd encourage anyone that if we don't get your question answered here to go on to the community chat and post some questions for Simon. Here's one. I've heard about X2A DNA discovered in the Great Lakes and Middle East areas. Is this valid? What is your understanding?
I did have one extra slide, and I'm going to click down to it. Okay. The X2A DNA is ancient. Okay. These are claims made by Rodney Meldrum and his Heartland group. Rodney Meldrum's a creationist, and he sees everything through a 6,000-year-old world, and all of his claims about the DNA are wrong. So the X2 DNA came into the Americas with the very first Americans. I did have a few extra slides about this, but I showed this slide earlier. The X2 DNA is just as old. And this shows the Heartland people doing some excavations. Rodney Meldrum, all of his claims are completely suspect. He has no scientific training, and that's why I didn't really address his work,
okay.
Because it's just crazy.
So maybe just one more question. What are the implications of recent discoveries of Mexico DNA 30,000 years ago as it relates to Native American genome? You kind of touched on that early on.
I'm pretty convinced that that's... the scientists that published the very recent work don't draw any link between that work on the 30,000-year-old Mexican and the Australasian DNA in South America that I mentioned. And I think that's because they just didn't have any firm evidence to link the two. They don't have any DNA from the Mexican. In fact, they don't have any human remains that survived from that Mexican site, but I'm almost convinced that what happened is you had a wave of essentially the Clovis group, huge populations of Indigenous Americans moving south around about 15,000 years ago, and they just absorbed the groups that were there. And so there were tiny traces of that Australasian DNA in Mesoamerica, mostly in Central South America.
Okay. One quick one. On the map slide, what does Kaya mean? K-Y-A. Someone asked.
Oh, K-Y-A, that's 1,000 years ago.
Oh, okay, 1,000 years ago. Okay.
Yeah, sorry. Sometimes I use BP and sometimes K-Y-A. Sorry, yeah, so.
Okay. Well, thanks, Simon. We're out of time, so everyone, thanks for coming to the presentation. It was very well accepted. Great information, Simon. Hope you'll continue to publish this, and hope to see you on the chat boards with the conference. And thanks again for your time, Simon.
Oh, you're welcome, Brett. Thank you. Thanks for attending, folks.